side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day, it will brighten all our way if we keep on the sunny side of life.
All right, welcome to the third edition of the Export Finance Podcast. I'm joined here by the three musketeers, Simon Sayer, Simon Jones, and Gabby Buck. Welcome, everyone. And today, the topic, which is the issue of private insurance, and that's an issue that obviously, you know, the relationship between banks and private insurance is one that's kind of constantly evolving. So I wanted to ask, first question, to what extent are you using the private insurance market to support medium and long-term export finance transactions? Simon?
In a word, extensively. We like the private insurance market, and the experience that we have with it has been very, very good. So for us, it started about 16 years ago. So around 99, 2000 was when we first started using private insurance to really to cover down payment financings on ECA covered deals. So the 15% or the local content that can't be included under an ECA facility. And it was flexible, it was easy to use, we started getting familiar with the wording, the process, our credit departments liked it, and from there we've developed it into doing standalone private market insured transactions using the private insurers as if they were an ECA, but without many of the complicated OECD rules that go hand in hand with ECAs. So a lot, I have to say, the experience has been very good over that period. So 16, 17 years of experience is good. You need a few claims from time to time to test the system, not so many to test the system too much, of course. But for us, it's been a very, very good model and also a good experience, actually. It's a great compliment. And as I see the ECAs and the private market sort of slowly come to terms with each other and work more with each other, I think that's a great thing for the export finance market as well.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, is this level of activity, I mean, would you say Deutsche Bank are earlier adopter or a higher user than other banks? Do you think sort of it's fair to say?
I don't know if we were an early adopter. I think others were doing it at the same time. We were probably one of the early adopters. I think that's probably fair to say. I can think of other institutions that use private insurance as much as we do. We're certainly not alone in the marketplace. I think the way we've used it in export finance probably is a little bit more prevalent to other institutions. Deutsche has always been an institution that likes to be hedged. So for us, it was another hedging tool. And to go with CDS and selling down risk, of course, cash sales, unfunded sales, and the PRI market was a natural development of that as well. So it's been a sort of a natural product for us to use more and more.
And Simon and Gabe, do you concur with that? Or?
Yeah, I mean, Simon and I actually worked on, in the early 2000s, some deals together where we both used credit risk insurance. I'll pick Simon up on that. I'm a big believer in not calling it PRI, because PRI might mean private risk insurance to Simon, but it actually, to our risk committees, means political risk insurance, which has a completely different connotation and gets a bad press. So credit risk insurance is what I'd rather call this. I agree with Simon about the timing. I think it did start around the late 1990s, early 2000s, and that was because that was when the private insurance market became more relevant to the banks. It recognised political risk insurance wasn't being used, and it created a new product specifically that banks would appreciate and like and be able to use to get capital relief and risk transfer. And they continue to evolve that to make sure it does remain relevant to clients. So I think it's a very important part of the market. Some banks like it, some banks don't. At TD, we don't. It's not a product we do use, but I know the product well. I know the insurance market and have been working with it for a while. And I think it is relevant to the industry. It has a role that it will never, ever replace the ECA market. They both have their own niche and role in this.
Gabby?
In my previous shop, we didn't use it at all. Notwithstanding the fact that the insurance market, in my opinion, did do a lot of good change in terms of making their product much more compliant to regulatory changes that were going on. But, you know, it's a form of de-risking. And where I was before, we just, you know, when we booked an asset, we were always looking to book that asset on a mark-to-market basis. If it was done on a positive mark-to-market basis, you could sell it. If you could sell it, you sold it. Having insurance, I think, was very useful for pre-export finance for relatively short term. But for the long-dated infrastructure finance, even on the commercial associated with an export credit, you know, our viewpoint was, is this a good underlying credit? If it is it priced well and structured well, then you can sell that on a cash basis to other institutions. And that then delevered the risk associated with the underlying trade. And so for us, it was, you know, we looked at, I remember looking at you two guys, particularly Simon, I think, where you were very active in using PRI as a way of creating a competitive advantage in the market. But for us, it was just, you know, it was a bit like Marmite. You either love it or you hate it, yeah. Right? And it just didn't work for us.
Yeah. But the banks that did do it spent a lot of time with their risk committees investing in the product up front. I mean, I remember we took at my, where I was in the late 1990s, we actually took a secondi in from Willis. Bit of plug there for Willis. On secondment for a year to help us get comfortable with the product before we built it up. And then we became a very, very big user. And DB and ABN AMRO were two of the biggest users of the product in this export credit arena. And we were doing deals. I agree, 10 is an issue, but you can still go 10 years at least. And there are some transactions we can go out further than 10 years with the private market, which wasn't the case early stages. You know, it was a 5-year market, then became a 7-year market. And then...
Yeah, but our philosophy was... if you had a choice between having the asset on your balance sheet with a PRA cover or being able to sell it, which is the better of the two?
Yeah, right. You were in the investment bank, therefore had a certain mindset.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know whether you were in your investment bank or not at that time, Simon, but we were in a client-driven commercial bank, and we wanted to do the transactions for our clients and risk mitigate them to the best possible way. Distribution to other banks was part of that, but this was yet another tool the bank was using for distribution.
Yes, yeah. And we had, even though we're in the investment bank, we have banking book treatment for our trade businesses, so it's not a mark-to-market business. And I think that's right, actually. I don't think trade suits a mark-to-market business with the volatilities you have in it, and I'm not comfortable with trying to earn everything up front either. I think that's the wrong approach. But yeah, the when we first started working with the private insurance market, we could only work with one insurer as an acceptable risk mitigant within the institution. There's only one that had been put through our credit department. There were many ECAs, of course, but only one private market insurer, which was AIG. And the reason it was them was because they had a triple A rating, and so the bank liked the rating, was attracted to that. And well, there are all. I think credit analysts always talk about sort of two ratings or two separate and distinct analyses that they'll undertake of the insurers. One is their credit rating, but the second is their sort of rating for their ability and willingness to pay. Yep. And that's an important component too. But from those early days with one and goodness knows, I think AIG never realised they had a monopoly on the business, thankfully, and we were able to add other private market insurers to the list successively. To now, we work with something like 50 different underwriters across the corporate market and the Lloyd's of London market.
And that is the way to do it, because I think if you're going to sell internally a credit insurance risk business, it has to be diverse across a range of insurers. If you have all your eggs in one basket, it's not going to last for very long, is it? So you had to change, I guess.
And what's the, I mean, you know, has the response, the attitude amongst customers changed to using, you know, especially, I guess, customers where you've sold ECA insurance, ECA cover in the past? What's their attitude to private insurance? Has it changed at all?
Well, I think that's very simple, actually, because they don't really see it. No. Our exporting clients love it because for them it's a solution. They get to sell into markets that either ECAs aren't on cover for, or for which obtaining ECA cover is challenging because of national content rules. So the exporters love it. The buyer doesn't really know it's there. That there are disclosure issues around the private market, which means that the involvement of the insurer is not visible to the obligor, and that's an important tenet of the private market. So I think really, you know, clients love it, but they don't really know why they love it. It's just making their deals happen.
It's very much an internal risk management tool for the banks, which, to be perfectly honest, is how export credits used to work. I mean, I can remember when we all started in this, insurance premiums from the ECAs were not allowed to be disclosed to the borrower. Were they?
Yeah, that's true.
They were always part of the contract from the exporter. And so the market has changed markedly in export credits, and in insurance product, it's something, it's a risk management tool the banks use. They just have their relationship with their client. Their client can see them lending them 5-year money and think, great, this is fantastic. The fact the bank has insured some of that is the bank's business, and that's how it was. It is viewed, I think.
And then, so can I clarify? Is that sort of is it viewed as a BAL compliant risk mitigant?
BAL 2. I don't personally think it fits.
There are legal opinions, I understand, that exist that confirm BAL 3 compliance.
Yeah, agree with that. But BAL 3, so most banks working under the advanced approach do consider it an acceptable risk mitigant under BAL 3. Now, Article 194 legal opinions on ECA cover, going to have to go through the same process on private insurance cover as well. Mm-hmm. And there might be some challenges ahead. Because the wording, which works very well in the market of policies, is not always going to be as clear as a guarantee under an ECA policy, or even insurance under those ECAs that work with insurance. But look, I think the private market has been so good at responding and providing products that banks want, they'll get there.
Yeah,
they will get there. And if there are small deficiencies and small gaps between what Article 194 legal opinion requires in terms of BAL 3, then the market will move.
Yep. Yeah,
and banks have different interpretation as to what the regulation really means for them and how the policy fits.
Mm. Agree. So, follow-up question on that. Do the BAL rules, particularly the leverage ratio, make it advantageous for banks to now have a mixture of better-rated ECAs and lower-rated private market insurers supporting your export finance book?
I think there's two parts to that question. I think that the issue of yield will be very important when trying to make assets fit within the leverage ratio. And so, therefore, where an export credit agency is slightly further down the credit curve in comparison to others, there's going to be banks more attracted to those ECAs because it will hit their leverage ratio returns targets. But the flip side, going back to the private insurance, is I think the private insurance market, and I'm interested in Simon Sayer's view on this, I think it's going to struggle a bit when the leverage ratio is going to be kicking in fully, because it doesn't give a deleveraging of the bank's balance sheet in terms of, because the asset is still on the bank. You've just got a risk mitigant from a credit risk perspective. And so therefore, you don't get relief as you would do in terms of selling that asset to a third party.
Mm. Yeah, no, that's true. It still sits on the balance sheet. That's for sure. But I think you've been reading my strategy paper, Dan, because that's a very very relevant question to the way we approach the business these days. And addressing leverage ratio with just a book of Hermes covered assets or US Exim covered assets isn't going to work. And the stuff that you do keep on the balance sheet needs to look good under a leverage ratio lens. And one of the ways of achieving that is by having a mix of better rated but also slightly weaker rated assets. The weaker rated assets, of course, generate more risk capital, and that means you're getting closer to what the leverage ratio targets are going to be for the overall capital allocated to that book. So that's exactly the approach we take. And when I look at the portfolio of assets that we keep on the balance sheet, it includes better rated ECA assets, weaker rated ECA assets, PRI covered assets. It includes the residual risks we will guarantee under those ECA programs where you have an unfunded contingent liability, such as, for example, the Nordic ECAs, where you provide a guarantee to another lender, but the lending is off balance sheet. You syndicate, you sell down, you underwrite, and all of that that you keep on the balance sheet serves to make your on-balance sheet book look sufficiently attractive to continue to command resources internally, and everything else that's off the balance sheet, well, the bank loves that because it's off balance sheet. So important to have the right mix on both.
Yeah, well, the good news and bad news. Good news is I haven't read your strategy paper. The bad news is that question may have come from a broker. We'll call them Tyler Durden. But you know, maybe that broker read your strategy paper. Who knows? Yeah. Speaking of brokers, do you see conceivably a situation where, you know, insurance brokers who currently are able to broker deals for MIGA or for private insurers could become involved in the process of actually brokering deals that involve ECAs as well?
What do you mean by brokering deals with ECAs?
Oh, not with ECA, but sort of arranging ECA cover, as you know, in the same way. So you know, they have a client. The client wants a solution. They go to market. They find the best price with the private insurer. They may find the best price with MIGA. You know, you have ECAs where, you know, they're able to cover is very different. You know, it's changing all the time. Could there be a situation where actually that just becomes another, you know, another form of cover?
So they become the originator, structure and arranger of ECA facilities with
ECA cover.
And I don't see that happening in my lifetime.
Well, that's
you're not that young, Gabby.
Well, hang on. So,
that's why I was able to say it, right?
But if you think about what you just said, they come the originator, structurer and arranger of an ECA facility. I think actually there are some people doing that in the market today with ECAs. And there are one or two advisory boutiques.
Oh, yeah, but they're not. But they're not the insurance market.
Now they are not insurance brokers. Let's be very clear.
So they're brokers in a more general.
So they're
term.
Brokers in a more general term. And but do I see a system where brokers work like they do in the private insurance market, or even with some of the multilaterals like MIGA? I agree. I think that's unlikely.
That's
I think
the
there's
job
an
of the banks.
There's an established practice here, yeah. And the other facilitator of course, and we referred to this earlier, is that the involvement of the ECA is just so visible to everybody. It's visible to the exporter, who quite often initiates the process. It's visible to the buyer and the obligor on the facility, who might themselves originate the process, and the bank. Whereas the insurance market, with the disclosure issues, and particularly the way the Lloyd's of London market works, where you have to use a broker, of course, comes from a very, very different approach. So unlikely.
Okay. Next, have you taken advantage of private insurers being outside of OECD agreement to offer, for example, finance of 100% of an export contract without the need for a 15% down payment?
Absolutely. That was one of the key benefits. When the banks in the early 2000s were developing their skills with the private insurance market, there were a couple of reasons why they were doing that. One, it was an additional tool. Two, it was perhaps a competitive tool as well. ECA premiums weren't as flexible. They have their minimum benchmarks, whereas the private insurance market can set the premium to where the deal needs to be to get done. And thirdly, the flexibility. So it was used for the down payment finance, as Simon said earlier. It was also used for 100% transactions, 100% financing solutions. And became a very, very... That's when I think it really grew the business. And it actually did become, in the shorter end space, so the 5 to 7 year, 5 to 10 year space, it became an absolute competitor to the ECAs and was used by my institution at the time very much in that way.
And in addition to that, there was a period where, as credit markets improved prior to the financial crisis, and a lot of emerging markets which previously hadn't had access to medium and long-term financing, as the credit markets improved, ECAs could not come back on cover for those markets because they had past due debts that were incurred in the 70s across much of Africa or LATAM or countries in Asia. They had to go through parish club processes, long-winded renegotiations, which meant that ECAs were not able to come back on cover, particularly for public sector obligors in challenging emerging markets. Private market, just like flicking a switch. You know, there's a price, we'll work with you there. And they made a great sort of gain in market share during that period, that sort of transitional period. And there are some countries for which that still applies. But, you know, looking at Africa now, ECA cover is generally available. But the private insurers were able to gain a foothold in that market at a time when the ECAs were, you know, by necessity, a little bit slower to move.
Yeah. The premium levels within the ECAs move behind the scenes. So as countries get upgraded, you have to wait till all the countries vote to upgrade the country. And therefore, the private market can slip in for 12 months and actually undercut the ECA. And that's exactly what we were doing in Kazakhstan.
Yeah.
That type of market.
Yeah, if a rating agency upgrades a country, the private insurance market can change the premium overnight, whereas the ECAs have to wait to the next OECD meeting, hope everyone's going to vote for it, and maybe then they'll change the premium.
So that being the case, are there any countries now that are ripe for private insurance cover, or is it sort of not specific at the moment?
A lot of countries are going the other way.
Yeah, of course, in a downgrade scenario, it does work the other way. And that's probably the sort of environment that we're in at the moment, really. Yeah. But yes, there are many countries where the private market still works very, very well. Absolutely.
Yeah. And is Solvency II having any impact on the way you work with private underwriters at the moment?
Not really noticeably for us, no. I think for Solvency II, there's big implications for matching assets with liabilities. And I think many of the large insurance companies in other parts of those entities, they're looking for longer dated assets to manage to sit with their longer dated liabilities. But not really in the private insurance market, the political and credit insurance market. So far for us, it hasn't really been a noticeable impact.
We saw it in my previous role, where life insurance companies, pension funds, had better capital treatment under Solvency II for infrastructure. And so they were very attracted to very long-dated assets that had an infrastructure bias and were wrapped by an ECA. And that depth of appetite and pricing for that was far cheaper than the banks.
As an investor. As opposed to an insurer. So different, the other side of the balance sheet for the insurance company.
So, yes, you know, I think there's a slight anomaly there between how the banks get regulated for a certain type of asset versus how pension funds and insurance companies work.
One of the key things about not moving off the Solvency II issue, if you don't mind, but the key ways I see the insurance market playing a role, and a very valid role, even though it's not the role they want to play, is the reinsurance market with the export credit agencies, because the agencies are doing the volume business and they do need to reinsure parts of their portfolio. And I think that's a very valid way the insurance companies can play a role. I think everything I've heard, the rhetoric from the insurance market, whether it's insurers or whether it's brokers, is they see themselves as a product that can compete with the export credit market. But I think it can only do so in a certain environment. It doesn't have large volumes. It can't do $1 billion a ticket. We did a transaction, I remember, a number of years ago, $150 million. We had to use five different insurers. We had to do a syndicated insurance transaction because no one had enough appetite to do the transaction. Now, I think the market is deeper than it was and it's longer than it was. But you can't fund 15-year infrastructure projects with private market insurance.
No, you're right. Although, and I would say, just to pick you up on the billion-dollar figure, interestingly now, when brokers and underwriters stand up and talk about what is the capacity in the private insurance market, the figure is typically between, if you add up all the lines that private insurers can write on a particular risk, somewhere between $1.6 and $1.8 billion. for a single deal. Now, you would have to be using the whole of the market to get there, and the tenors, I recognise, won't be at the 15-year end, more likely 3 to 5. But this is a big market, and that's a big capacity now.
They absolutely do play a role.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I think it's a backward step if the export credit agencies start reinsuring their portfolios. And I think for two reasons. One of the main advantages of an export credit from a borrower stroke issuer's perspective is the additionality, pure additionality of capacity, in that the agencies book and hold that risk. And because they don't do a portfolio basis of that, then an issuer can see that as being a form of liquidity which is separate from the bank and the bond market and insurance market. The second aspect is that the export credit agencies, you look at the default rates on their portfolio, and I think I'm correct in saying it's something like 0.04% of their total portfolio. You know, as a taxpayer, why would you want to get rid of an asset that is so low in terms of default and is giving you high premium, which is helping you to cover the business going forward on a long-term basis?
Which, of course, is one of the reasons, Gabby, that so many private insurers have come into the market over the last few years, because those default rates have been incredibly low. And the amount of new capacity coming in from specialty insurers, reinsurers who want to come into the primary market, new startups, has been extraordinary.
Yeah, but the ECAs are only you doing that as a way of freeing up exposure, because they have their own constraints. So an ECA may have a capacity of $1 billion in a certain market. So once it's hit that billion, it either has to reinsure to do more business, or it can't do it.
Well, you know, I'm going back to the earlier question about OECD, non-OECD. Yeah. You know, my viewpoint is that, and my experience has been, that the export credit agencies, whether they're in or outside of OECD, are unbelievably active in terms of competing against each other, because they have a political agenda of supporting their exporters, which in turn supports their GDP growth. You know, on the question about 100% financing, I've seen 100% financing with export credit agencies. There are some rules and regulations as to how it's applied to get there, but it's been done. You would never have seen that 5-6 years ago. So the competition for to support your exporters is a very strong political agenda, which is being fed to the ECAs. Do what you need to do to win business.
Just a point of clarification. So you mentioned sort of ECA reinsurance, or reinsurance of ECAs being a backward step. Do you mean ECAs reinsuring with the private market, or in ECAs reinsuring with each other as well?
Funnily enough, I do get the story about ECAs reinsuring with ECAs, in that there can be a sector stroke geographic concentration by certain ECAs. And I think there's a role that they could, you know, do some asset swap or risk insurance swap. So, you know, a classic example could be, you know, the Nordics being quite long on telco exposure and wanting to reinsure part of that portfolio with another export credit agency who may have, you know, concentration risk in Africa, and they can flip that. I get that. And that just, you know, prudent financial management. But selling off your exposure into the insurance market, which then can then get traded, I think from a borrower's perspective, starts to lose some of the shine that an ECA provides.
I see where you're coming from with that, Gabby, but I think there's nothing wrong with generating new capacity. And if an ECA is at its limit for a particular country or borrower, it's got an exporter knocking on the door,
when
the only
you,
way to
you,
do a new deal.
Have you actually seen, I've never, where an export credit agency says, I'm full, right?
Yes,
and never, I've had agencies said, my maximum limit on this country's, one example I've got in mind is 500 million sterling. We pushed it to 2 billion. Because at the end of the day, the delta between the two is about jobs in that particular country. And
no, but equally, though, I think there are, I mean, I know that can be true, but I also know the other is true as well, that deals have not been done because
Of capacity.
Yeah.
Just on the ECA to ECA, really interesting concept, and the portfolio diversification is a great idea as well. But the challenge comes if there's ever a default and an ECA is sitting on debt from a country or a borrower where there have never been any exports from that country to that defaulting borrower, the taxpayer, imagine explaining that to the electorate and the taxpayer. We've just had to pay out on a claim in such and such a country, but we've never had any exports there.
Deals have been done. I mean, Gabby wasn't far wrong in his example of a real deal that was done, and the two markets that were swapped by a Nordic ECA and another European ECA were Oman and Mexico, because one didn't have any exposure in one and one had over, and they just swapped those. That deal happened 15 years ago, so that was, that's a long time ago.
And moving to final question on sort of moving back onto the private insurance sort of side of things. Simon, you mentioned before about whether the private insurers can compete with the ECA. So actually, taking that point, when can they compete? When would you choose to use private insurance as opposed to ECAs, and what are the advantages of, in that case versus mm-hmm. ECA? How do you see it?
Yeah, I think one of the things we touched on in the previous two podcasts ago.
spoiler alert.
was the fact that the role of the bank in servicing its clients is it gets a question from a client, I need to fund this project. The bank goes away. ECA is not the only solution. And it could be the bond market, it could be the syndicated loan market, it could be domestic market. And the bank would do that analysis as to what is the optimum financing for this. And if you have an issue where you need to do 100% financing or you need to achieve a certain price, then the insurance market, the private insurance market, is potentially going to be an option. However, one has to recognise that transaction is likely going to have to be between 3 and 10 years, for instance. That project is likely going to have to be a maximum of a couple of $100 million because of capacity issues. So I think the insurance market plays a very important role, and it will just be put in the pot with other forms of liquidity and capital for the bank to assess which is the most appropriate for this particular transaction for this particular client.
I've got four, I think, where there are times when the insurance market will win hands down from the ECA. I think is where you're looking on a portfolio basis on a number of transactions and you want to obtain protection. I think the other aspect is when it's short-term and revolving facilities. But I think the last two, which I think are the most important, is where you've got and want sourcing flexibility. And so therefore trying to identify early on up front where you're going to get your equipment from or goods and services and which ECA is going to be applicable, I think it's going to be challenging. But the last and foremost where I think the insurance market wins is speed. I think their ability to come to the table really quickly is where they compete against the ECAs.
Okay. And Simon, anything you wanted to add to that as a final word?
I think they've covered it very well. Flexibility is my usual buzzword. It's a very, very flexible tool. And where you need that, then the private market works very, very well.
Okay. Well, gentlemen, thank you very much. Just a final word and a bit of a shameless plug, but we will be doing, a live panel at our conference in Rome on the 9th and 10th of June. We'll be looking at the future of export finance and the long-term future of export finance during that panel. But thank you very much. Thanks for listening, and thanks very much, gents.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help.